Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello and welcome to episode 126 of the world's first Paul Weller fan podcast. I'm Dan Jennings, and 10 years ago, I gave up my live streaming career as a radio presenter with one big regret: never getting to interview my hero, the legendary British musician Paul Weller. This podcast exists purely to solve that issue. Welcome to Desperately Seeking Paul. And in this episode of the podcast, our final one of 2022, I'm joined by an absolute legend, the multi-award-winning music photographer Jill Firmanofsky. We kick off with the start of her career in 1972, becoming in-house photographer at the Rainbow Theatre, where she specialised in live rock concerts. And over the past 50 years, she has photographed some of the greatest musicians on the planet, including Led Zeppelin, The Rolling Stones, Madness, Debbie Harry, Oasis, Joy Division, Queen, The Clash, and of course, The Jam, capturing amazing live shots from their live gigs, along with Paul Weller for The Face magazine and at Glastonbury Festival, is just a couple of examples. So we'll find out all about that, as well as her incredible website, rockarchive.com. A massive collection of not just Jill's work, but photographers and visual artists right across the planet. And do stick around at the end of this podcast for something pretty cool on that front as well. So another corking guest to the podcast. Let's get into it. Jill Firmanofsky, thanks for joining me.
You're welcome.
This is lovely to have you on, because not only are we going to talk about some of the pictures that us fans will have seen, but you've obviously got the archive there of stuff that we haven't.
Yes. Yes, I do. I'm not hiding it from you. I just haven't got around to it.
I should have popped round. This has been lovely in person. This is going to be really exciting. I want to dig into your memories as a photographer over the past, what are we talking now, 40, nearly 50 years?
This year's my 50th anniversary. Right. I began as a proper photographer, but I suppose. I mean, I did photograph with an Instamatic, you know, when I was a teenager. But yes, I mean, my first gig where I had a professional camera, although I wasn't professional by any means, was in 1972, January 72. So this is actually my 50th anniversary this year.
Oh, well, congratulations on that. And look, we're going to dig into some of these stories. And so those first shots, that pre 1972 was, I mean, I understand you were like a massive Beatles fans. Is it called an apple scruff? Is that what they call it?
Yes, I believe so. But unfortunately, I was a bit too young to be an apple scruff, because I was about 13 and you had to be more like 16. You know, that time, that age, the difference between 12, 13 and 16 is quite big. So the apple scruffs got to do little errands for the Beatles and, you know, go to the shop and buy them cigarettes and milk and stuff. The smaller ones just stood there in our school uniform, you know, or whatever it was that we were
just hanging around outside
Abbey Road. Yeah. And also I was a member of the fan club, so I had a card, and then you'd get, you know, your You'd get your news from the Beatles. You'd get the Beatle Monthly, which was an incredible publication, and see all the pictures in there, you see. So, you know, that, I think that started me off thinking that's what I've got to do.
So this love of music, this love of image and photography starts at a really young age. And you came over to London in the mid-60s, was that right?
Yes, that's correct, yeah. I was born in a little town in what was then Rhodesia and is now Zimbabwe. So I come from a family who were themselves refugees from one place or another, you know, at the turn of the century. So my father's a Lithuanian root and my mother from Germany. And lots of people sort of shunted their way through Africa around the time of the war, or way before the war, actually, in the case of the Lithuanians. They came in the sort of turn of the century. And so I was born in this little town called Bulawayo in 1965. No, I came in 65. I was born in 53, so I was 11.
And was music then a big part of your world back home? Were the Beatles and that before you came to London in the, 63 that had been around, right? Would that have been a thing? Was music a big thing in the household?
It was. It was a big thing, but it wasn't the kind of music I liked. It was my father actually played guitar in a dance band. That wasn't his job. I mean, he was an architect, but his hobby, he had two hobbies. Photography was one, and the other was playing guitar. And his favorite music was jazz. So he had a very big collection for the little town of Bulawayo of vinyl. You know, Louis Armstrong, Count Basie, Duke Ellington, Ella Fitzgerald, and so on and so on and so on. Blossom Dearie, I remember as well. And he would play these records on his, you know, much beloved stereo on the weekends, you know. And of course, it was an outdoor life, so you'd hear it outside. And I think I remember telling him to turn it off because, you know, he didn't like it. But it wasn't the beat. My one of my aunties was an Elvis fan. He really liked Elvis. I didn't know much who Elvis was. But the one record I remember sort of penetrated not just the white population, but also the black population, was the song My Boy Lollipop, which was the first release on Island Records, I think, big hit by Millie. We all loved that, the kids. And then the Beatles, of course, were starting through. And we were like, Beatles? You know, in Africa, we've got a lot of Beatles around, you know, dung Beatles and all kinds of Beatles. And we just thought it was maybe they were, I don't know, you know, biologists or something. We had no idea what the Beatles were. So it wasn't really till we came to London that I understood what they were, really.
Right. And as a teenager growing up in London in the swinging 60s, I mean, that's a huge, exciting time for music, but also the visualization of music at that time. So when we talk about photography, suddenly these bands are very photogenic. We're seeing images all over the place of these bands as well. So the two worlds colliding as a youngster must be a really exciting period, I thought.
Yes, that's absolutely true. I mean, I was just a schoolgirl, but we lived in London suburb of Kenton, and that was one Kingsbury actually was, and that was one stop from Wembley Park, and that's where Ready Steady Go was made. So you could also go there and get your autograph book and collect autographs. But so that Ready Steady Go is, you know, programs in those days that you watched were watched by everybody because there was only about two channels anyway. And Ready Steady Go was the one, I think it preceded Top of the Pops. And so, yeah, I mean, that's where you saw how to do your hair, what to wear, what to say, you know, and all those kind of things. And it was very visual. And it was also like a bit dangerous as well, you know, it was a new thing.
And you start doing a textile and graphic design course in London, and is it right after only a couple of weeks you get that gig as the official photographer at the Rainbow?
Less than, it was 4.5 days, actually. Yeah, I mean, somebody's making a documentary about my work, and that's how it begins, kind of things, with, you know, my arriving from Africa and being a Beatles fan, and then standing outside Abbey Road, and then that extraordinary block course that I did. I was doing a textile design course at the Central School of Art and Design, and you did like a 2-week course to photograph your work. You see, that's what it was for. But they had a really good department there, but it wasn't an art or anything. If you wanted to study photography, you went to technical college. Art schools didn't have photography courses, except at postgraduate level. If you were really serious, you'd do it once you'd done a degree and a DIP AD, Diploma in Art and Design. So you didn't do photography at art school.
Is that because the technicals, they were thinking it was all about learning, I don't know, the aperture and all that, the technical side of a camera?
Yeah, and then developing film and all that, you know, technicians, people in lab coats and, you know, that sort of thing. So we had this wonderful facility at the Central in the basement with dark rooms and things and very good teachers, but it wasn't something you could shift and say, I'd like to do that instead. I did this, it was the beginning of the second term of my first year. I was 18 and we did the course. And from the very first day, I was completely hooked. I mean, literally from the first day, my father had been a really good amateur and he'd had a dark room at home. So it kind of was in the blood already. And I was longing to get my hands on a proper camera, Pentax it was. And, you know, from the first roll of film, I was like completely hooked. So those 4 days were very long for me, because on the fourth day or the fifth day, when I had a ticket to see the group Yes at the Rainbow Theatre, I took the college camera, had an adventure where I thought, well, I'll take some pictures down the front. I can't, my balcony seat won't get me very good pictures. And then got this job. I mean, it wasn't a paid job. It was just access, really. By Monday, I had a job.
That is so brilliant. And we should say, I mean, this was a cinema at one point. I think it was like the biggest cinema in the UK or something, or maybe even Europe at one point.
Yes, I think so, yeah.
And it was the Finsbury Park Astoria. I don't know how early on in 72 it was, because some of the artists who's been playing, like Bowie, for instance, I was looking up like Ziggy Stardust, three concerts there on that. There's this wonderful story around the December gig where he asked people to come into the gig to bring toys for local children for Christmas. Mm. And then you've got Stevie Wonder, James Brown, Bob Marley. Amazing artists. My God.
Yeah, one after the other, really. Yeah.
And were you going along to most of these most nights?
I went to as many as possible. In the case of Bowie, he's one of the few missing big stars in my archive, because the night I went to Bowie with my little pass that said access all areas, Jill Fermanowski, a bouncer jumped off the stage and said, you can't photograph this. And I said, I can, I'm the photographer. And he went, you're not David Bowie's photographer. And he ripped the film out of the back of my camera. Completely freaked me out. And afterwards, I went backstage to complain to Bowie's manager. And he was like, oh, have this bottle of champagne, you know, like it was some joke or something. And years later, I didn't go back after that because it was pretty scary. And then years later, it was Mick Rock, who photographed Queen. And he said to me, oh, well, I said to them, I should be the only photographer, you know, you don't want anybody else. So I didn't ever photograph Bowie, although I saw him at the Rainbow and just wasn't able to photograph him and was freaked out. But yes, every night there was amazing stuff.
And we'll get on to the Jam, because that's where, you know, your paths first cross with Mr. Weller, is them playing the Rainbow. I think it's a sound check at the Rainbow. But I'd love to find out more about some of these. So Bob Marley, for instance, I mean, they played, I think 77, they played four nights at the Rainbow. Didn't you photograph Bob Marley in his hotel room?
I did, yeah. Jumping forward, really, I suppose, the Wailers kind of became known to me around 1975, 76 in the early days, because one of the prog bands that were around before punk, there was a couple of them really into the Wailers. And so I'd heard about them. But yes, I photographed Bob Marley in 78. I didn't photograph him at the Rainbow, I don't think, actually. I photographed him in somewhere else, like in the north somewhere. I'm just trying to remember where it was, because some of the films disappeared around that time. I've still got some live shots of Bob Marley wearing a Wailers knitted jersey that looked like his mum knitted for him or something. and I did in 78 photograph him in a hotel room. He was lovely. But I met Paul Weller. I met the Jam. I saw Paul Weller was around the punk era. I mean, 77, he was already around. And I think I had first photographed them at the Marquee, actually, or maybe even in some pub like the Hope and Anchor. And then also in 77, it would have been 77, 78, also in Tower Hamlets. And I don't know where that gig was, but they were wearing those suits. You know, there's kind of, they were kind of had a reddish tinge to them. They looked like two-tone suits. So, yeah, so, you know, we knew who they were, but they weren't typically punk. They didn't style themselves as punk, but their music was punk.
And was that music something that, I'm guessing, would, you know, was something that you're into, because this is a huge exciting time for young people having their own music to a certain extent. And you photographed the Clash, the Pistols, bands like the Ramones and stuff as well. So you were really central to that world from a visual point of view. So, but was it your bag musically?
I don't know if it was particularly. I just like the look and the energy of it. And, you know, I'm not actually, strangely enough, any kind of expert on music. I mean, my music is probably from the prog era. You know, I was a Pink Floyd photographer. I was in the camp that Johnny Rotten said, you know, we hate Pink Floyd. So I wasn't in that camp, but I really loved the energy. And I was of the same age as the punks, you know, more or less, actually, maybe a year older than some or a year or two older than some. But I think Joe Strummer and I were the same age. And also that art school background, Joe Strummer had been there. Lena Lovitch actually was another one in my college, where music and art have a very strong connection in the UK. You know, John Lennon went to art school. Roxy Music went to art school. Joe Strummer went to art school. So you've got these connections between art school and music. But I really like the energy of that punk music and got really involved in one of the first independent labels, Step Forward Records, with Mark Perry and Harry Malofsky, who started the fanzine Sniffing Glue. And they liked the jam. So that was good, because if they hadn't, they would tend to be down on bands that they, you know, you're either in or out. But I mean, I think they were accepting of the jam.
Now, there's obviously that difference between capturing something live and that energy that you talk about of punk and any band, I suppose, that live experience versus studio work or Bob Marley in a hotel room, for instance. What is it that you're looking for when you're capturing, when you're front row like that and it's going off and it's, you know, 10 million miles an hour? I mean, I've got so many questions. How do you know what you're getting is any good? But what is it that you're trying to capture when you're looking down that lens?
You just hope that it's going to be in focus and that you haven't fucked it up. I mean, the point about that kind of era that is just that everybody was totally amateur. I mean, it was the era of, if you can play three chords, you can form a band. So they were crap. I was a really crap photographer, as far as it, well, you know, from the point of view of I was untrained and inexperienced. Nobody really cared. I'd studied graphic design. I moved to graphic design in order to stay at art school because textile design said they weren't going to carry on hosting me. Graphics took me on. So I had to do a bit of typography and a bit of graphic design. So, you know, I was helping people also design record covers or pasting it together. But it was all done with cow gum and glue. And if you weren't sniffing it, you were using it to paste up your album sleeve. Very amateur, and suited me brilliantly.
It's interesting. On the podcast, the people we talk to, like the promoters and the managers and the pluggers, like so many people just, because this didn't exist before, you're just making it up as you go along, really.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, the Sex Pistols, they were one outrage after the other, you know, and Malcolm McLaren was sort of holding the strings of the puppet, really. And he was loving it. And he had an office, Malcolm did, above the prog bands that I was working with, Miles Copeland and his coterie of prog bands, and then the booking agent, John Sherry, used to book gigs. And then Sniffing Glue, they broke into an office there. It was like, a, you know, offices and corridors, put an electricity cable through Copeland's window into theirs, and they used to sleep there so that you could go to the 100 Club. I mean, it was just all
absolute chaos.
Chaos and anarchy in the UK.
Yeah.
For a little while. And remember, it only lasted about 18 months, the whole thing.
Yes. And some of these gigs, I mean, I don't know how you were getting shots at all being bashed, but the energy was one thing. But actually, some of these, it kind of tips over, really. There are fights and riots and all sorts of lots of these gigs, weren't there?
Yes, yes. I mean, I remember the Clash playing the Rainbow. They broke up all the seats and things like that. So, yeah, that was scary at times. It was scary. Not so much scary at the smaller gigs, because they only held about, I mean, they were packed, but there was only fit in about 100, 150. Maybe the 100 Club was probably more. So that was a bit scarier still. The worst thing that could happen, really, was that you get beer or worse, gob all over you from people. Spitting and throwing liquids around. So I remember wearing a plastic raincoat at one or two gigs, yeah.
Oh, I don't understand the spitting thing. It's just the most bizarre thing.
Neither did the American bands. They were horrified.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, let's talk about a couple of these shots. So the Jam, famously, letting fans into sound checks was a really big thing. And so, like, kids who couldn't either afford to go to the gig or weren't allowed to go to the gig in the evening, often John Weller's letting them into the sound check. And there's a shot of, this would have been, what was it, 78? At the Rainbow. Of a sound check. Can you remember that? Can you remember being let in as a photographer taking photos? And were there fans that were let in for that as well?
I was allowed in anyway, because I had that access to all areas pass, so sound checks were okay for me. But they were very laid back about it, and I just wandered over the stage and stuff like that. John Weller's really important figure in the Jam's history, obviously. You know, he was a father figure. He was literally the father figure, obviously, for Paul, but he was a kind of father figure generally. I mean, he really got it. And I think the whole family were involved, his mum as well, and his sister, of course, later on, but she must have been very young then. And so it was a family affair. So there were some people hanging about at the soundcheck. I wouldn't have known who they were. Whether he let them in or not, I don't know. You did have this feeling that the jam organisation, which was around that Weller family, were a sort of in their own bubble within the punk.
They had the energy of punk, but you know, it's a different sound, isn't it?
Yeah, different sound, different, and certainly different packaging.
Yeah, and different. Yeah, totally.
They were more mod packaging, weren't they, really?
Around that time, obviously, the Jam are then kind of getting big as well. They're starting to have number one singles. Yeah, they're touring the world, Japan, the States, and that kind of thing. But they're, you know, they're having big singles, big albums. The fan base is huge. Did your access change to the band at that point? Did you, or was it still kind of quite easy to kind of get shots of the band?
They were on my radar, but I was working for the music press at that time. I was doing lots and lots of different jobs, so I wouldn't have been trying to get in unless somebody asked me to do something. And so I didn't really document the Jam as such, unlike, say, the Police, for example, where in the case of Police, I was on the road with them and was doing shoots with them and that sort of thing. That wasn't the case of the Jam. They were just in the vicinity of what I was doing. And I had intermittent contact with them, and you'd bump into Paul from time to time and, you know, see him somewhere and say hello to him and that sort of thing.
You mentioned the magazines and being part of that world. There's a lovely piece, 1983, The Face magazine, which was another Weller connection. So this point, the Jam are split. We're into, I don't even know if we were straight into the Style Council at that point. I think when you you first took the shots, it hadn't been quite revealed, but certainly when it was then published in Face magazine, they talked about the Style Council being just Paul and Mick, and they were looking for a female singer at that point. So this is a different side of Paul Weller. He's out of the Jam, punk's long gone, and we're into a period of new romantics and the Style Council being a very jazz kind of sound and stuff. So this is a different Paul Weller entirely.
Yes. I mean, in my documentary, I've said, you know, Paul Weller, Paul Smith and The Face, that's like a three-way marriage in heaven. You know, they were made for each other. And who would have thought? I guess it wasn't really a surprise. And also remember that Nick Logan, who started The Face, he was a great revolutionary and was the editor of the NME before that. He's one of the most least celebrated editors ever in the press. He was like, he could have been Paul Weller himself. He wore the Paul Smith suits. He had the same haircut. He was a mod, really, and he was obviously older than Paul. They were mirrors of each other, and he commissioned me to do Paul for The Face. That was really the first time I got to really chat to Paul, you know, work with him and so on. I wish I'd been a better photographer then. I must admit that I was winging it when I started in the studio as well. I hadn't been trained, so I had my own studio at that point, but I was still pretty green. It wasn't like he came, like some of them did later, with an entourage of hair, makeup and, you know, stylists. I mean, he was just wearing his normal clothes, but they were all immaculate. I don't know who was ironing his shirts, and everything was on a hanger nicely. I mean, you probably seen the shot of him from behind. Have you that one?
Yeah, I've got it here.
Shoes and, yeah. You know, he was so neat and tidy, and he had a beautiful physique as well. I mean, he took his shirt off at one point. He had beautiful, beautiful chest. I mean, he was just a lovely looking guy. And also, one thing about him that was there from the very start, actually, which I haven't mentioned, but was really there written across his head from the first moment I met him as a punk, was that he was serious. He wasn't mucking about. He was doing it. And he was doing it. I mean, he was a man absolutely driven. And I think it's the same to this day. It's like he was born to do it. And that is quite rare in my experience. He was a serious guy. And, you know, when he came to, I mean, it wasn't that he wasn't funny or amusing or all the rest, but something must have driven that kid. And by the time he came to my studio, and he was in his mid-20s, I guess, then he was on his way to fuck knows where, but he was going. He was there, and, you know, so he had his suits and his clothes, and he knew what he was doing. And his relationship with Mick, who I think came to that shoot as well, or it might have been a separate shoot I did with them, was also quite funny. It was like almost Mick was Mr. Ordinary in a strange kind of way. He didn't look like a rock person. And so they were a funny couple, those two, you know, obviously great mates. And then there was a girl called Tracy, was it, that also did singing for them. I think I photographed her as well. And for Paul, we used, what you call it, one of those mirrors with curves in it and stuff that makes everything go bendy. He was up for that as well, you know. I mean, he was up for it, but he was serious.
And he's somebody that's always, from talking to people on this podcast, he's always had a very visual side to his music, in the sense that every album that's released is packaged beautifully with great imagery. The, you know, the visuals that
you know, accompany all of him with magazines and newspaper and stuff are always immaculate and perfect. So did he come to that session with an idea of what he wanted to get out of it? Was it collaboration? Was it or the like the bendy mirror? Was that coming from you going, here's what I want, and then him kind of working with you?
Well, he knew he was doing a shoot for the cover of The Face, and it's enormously prestigious, even for somebody who was already very successful. So he made an effort. You know, he came with his clothes. I think the mirror thing was my idea. We did some with it and some without and so on. I have to go and have another look at that shoot to let you know better.
Yeah, the funny thing is, I think he'd still fit into that suit.
I bet he would. Exactly. Doesn't that say a lot? Yeah. And then all was cigarettes even, you know, all everything was so stylish. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a beautiful jacket, isn't it? With the checked jacket and the red in
red lining. Yeah, yeah. Stunning.
Absolutely stunning. You presumably the interview with Paul that became part of that article came separate. You weren't involved in that. You were kind of providing the shots. But sometimes I guess the shots become part of the article. Like you're trying to tell a story through the photos as well. Would that be the case?
Yeah, I suppose so. You see, The Face gave prestige to photographers that we hadn't had before. So what happened was you got your own shoot with an artist prior to The Face.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
It's literally, you go with the journalists, they were the kings, they did their interview, you shot them being interviewed in the same room, which was quite nice. And if you were lucky, if the PR didn't chuck you out immediately for the next lot, you got 5 minutes to do a portrait. And that's how it was. This was now the opposite. The journalist got 5 minutes for an interview and you got an hour to take pictures. And not quite, but, you know, the whole thing twisted on its head because of The Face, really. And that became more important to get a cover and a big spread in pictures. So I don't know about, you know, there were picture stories in The Face, but, you know, it was more like Vogue, really. You change of clothes, another picture, you know, hair a bit different or change the lighting a bit.
The twist on that at that point then becomes that you're getting credited as well, which didn't always happen. So suddenly now, and I think this is probably still true to this day, a lot of the time in these magazines, like the photographer is credited with the shots in the article too, which prior to that, I don't think really happened, did it?
That's right. It certainly didn't happen in my very earliest days. And when I asked for a credit, I remember Ray Coleman of Melody Maker saying, you'll get one when you deserve one. Like, you know, it was like, I've had a cover or two by then as well. I thought, well, when will I deserve a credit? Or they would credit their own house photographers, but not the freelancers. So The Face was the opposite. They couldn't pay, you see. They didn't have any money. So the one thing they could offer was a byline, a really good one. So yeah. And also Nick Logan was the first to credit photographers properly in NME before that, and smash hits after that. We all got credited by Nick Logan. So we all worshipped him, really. I mean, because he understood the value of visuals more than anybody.
That's really nice, because it's also something I've noticed about doing this podcast is that actually Paul Weller as a subject is quite easy to research, because he always has always credited everybody on everything. From the very first Jam album, he'll call out every producer, engineer, every artist, every photographer from day one. And I don't know where that comes from, but that's a lovely thing to have done throughout his entire career.
Yes, it is. It's generous, isn't it?
Absolutely. Now, the other photo I could find in your archive, which is huge and immense, and obviously this is the stuff that's out there in the world, not your personal one at home there on the hard drive, was 2015. So Paul Weller solo at Glastonbury. But I'm guessing there would have been shots between that Face shoot and that 2015 time, would there, with Paul?
Yes. I don't know if I did shoots with him actually, but as I said, he was around. And of course, he became a very good friend with Oasis. And so I'd see him come to gigs and things like that, just say hello. And I didn't really follow his career, you see. I mean, also, he had very, very good photographers like Lawrence Watson and people around him who you know, in that era of rock, you tended to have your bands that you, you know, you guarded a little bit with, like, that's one of my groups and so on. Not really, but, you know,
yeah.
Not like Mick Rock. Yeah. So Paul was, and Penny Smith, who I think did some of the most brilliant pictures of her, and Virginia Turbitt did some great shots of Paul in that era. In Rock Archive, we, you know, we try to bridge all these things together. You know, I mean, if I didn't photograph that era, somebody else did, and we've always tried to sort of find who did the great pictures in the time. But for myself, he was just a person to say hello to, and he came in the studio, still does. I saw him not that long ago coming in with Noel. You know, I know they're huge mates. And Noel actually recorded in his studio.
Oh, well, I was going to ask you about Rock Archive, because this is, I mean, a huge online collection of your photography, but also of others as well. And I was wondering, I mean, in the photographic world, do you see each other as competitors, or are you, you know, colleagues? And yeah, how is it? So there's people like Samuel Weller point of view, you mentioned some of them, but Martin Goddard, mm. Steve Rapport, who's been on the podcast, Garib Mankiewicz, mm. Virginia Turbitt, who's coming on the podcast. I'd have thought you'd be all like, you know, I want to get that shot or whatever, but it seems like you're all mates and friendly then, if you're, because it's your way, you own the Rock Archive and you've let them in. So
I only started Rock Archive because I could. I after my Oasis exhibition in the 90s, I had all this equipment, and also we'd had a website, which was very rare in 1997. There wasn't that many websites around, so I thought this should really be a more general thing than just Oasis. So when I started Rock Archive as a URL, I thought that's a good one, and what can I put in it? So then I spoke to various friends of mine who were photographers, and I said, why don't you each put in like five pictures? You don't need to put in your best one, just give us five that we can make prints from and start it off. And really the reason behind it was to, I thought we should have, there'll be a rock and roll museum at some point in the country, or we should have one.
It's mad that there isn't, isn't it?
But this has been my bugbear for years.
Mad.
And my last one was trying to get Hampstead Police Station as the jailhouse rock museum, which would have been brilliant, but it's been sold for property development and so on. And so I didn't think for a minute that Rock Archive, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary next year, I didn't think for a moment it would be necessary to have that for so long. I thought there'd be a museum, then we can sort of hand it over. There hasn't been. I'm fascinated by photographers. Fascinated, I always have been. And very grateful to the ones that helped me when I was starting out, because I was so amateur, you know, in a drum solo. How do you process your film? I might put them and go, 9.5 minutes, microphone, 68 degrees. See, I still remember that.
And that's burnt in.
Yeah. But others might elbow you out the way, especially young girl, you know, sort of like, get out my way. You know, I'm working for the Daily Mail or something, you know, that sort of thing. So you'd get that sort of thing. And then, as I say, we were a bit territorial about our bands as well, but I've always, you know, with Oasis, I always said, no, work with everybody. You know, I can't shoot everything anyway. And some people will be better at some things than others. And Mick Rock, I mean, he stopped me photographing Bowie. You know, I thought that was appalling when I finally found out.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think we mentioned
that. Really pissed off. Still pissed off now, Mick. No, I love the photographers, and I've interviewed a lot of them for Rock Archive. And then they, you know, luckily I did, because they've died. Elvis's photographer, Don Hunstein, who photographed Dylan a lot. I felt a kind of love for them, really. Hope that we could also help. I mean, you know, they write to us and go, I don't know what to do with the copyright issue, or, you know, that sort of thing. So I thought what it is, or the idea of it, was that it would be an archive of archives.
And all these portfolios within for each of these different photographers. Another way is that, like, you can look by a photographer, but you can also look by artists. So if you're passionate about, you mentioned Oasis, and we'll talk about that in a second as well, but you're suddenly in this Oasis archive, but there's not just your photos. There's lots of others from other photographers as well, which is lovely.
Well, that's what it should be. I mean, this is as close as we can get to some sort of a visual museum online. And I only wish that somebody would actually make it a reality.
Well, there you go. That's the next project. Let's talk Oasis, because you worked so much with them and documenting their career right from the early days, 1994 to 2009. Would that be right?
Yes. I mean, I still work with Noel now, but yes, absolutely. 1994 to 2009. Yeah.
Yeah. And lots of Weller connections with that band, like you mentioned, yeah, you know, mates and all that, and him turning up and playing with them at times and things like that. But how did you first get introduced to Oasis? What was the first shoot? What was the first connection? How did you get that gig?
I had been trying to publish a book of my work, which I'd had so many rejection letters from publishers, and the book finally got a publisher. And it was called The Moment, and it came out in 1995, but I'd been working on it for years. And when the publishers gave me the go-ahead around 1994, beginning of 94, and it was a sort of a diary from being a Beatles fan to And I thought, well, I don't want the book to date too much, so it would be good if it had an up-and-coming band. And Daniela Suave, who I worked with a great deal on Record Mirror, and also I'd seen a bit on MTV by that time, she told me about Oasis. And I'd already, as I say, seen them and thought they were really great. I thought, brilliant. They're a bit Beatly, and it's from the Beatles to Oasis. That'd be good, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Band up-and-coming. So I contacted their PR company and went to the Cambridge Corn Exchange in December 1994 and sent them the pictures, and they absolutely loved them. And also, I didn't know this, but they were looking for a photographer at the time. And Johnny Hopkins, who was their PR, very clever guy, he thought best to get a woman in because, as Noel says in my documentary, the management did get that right. They had a female tour manager. He said, if you put blokes working with us lot would have been a disaster. But they had respect. They had respect for women through their mother, Peggy, I guess. So
yes, yeah.
There were a lot of women around them, yeah. I kind of got the gig by default, really. I was ending my book and thought, well, that's it. I probably won't do that much rock anymore. And on the contrary, I got swept off in the Comet, and then just thought, got to really run with this one because I didn't do the Beatles. I was too young to do that, but I can do this great, great band here. And also they were as a bit like Elvis, and the Elvis photographer, Alfred Wertheimer, said, they allowed closeness, they allowed intimacy, they allowed it.
There's some moments that, I mean, you're traveling the world with the band. They've just become the biggest band in Britain. And it feels like almost overnight. It's such a quick thing from, and I know Noel talks about this in one of the Oasis documentaries, might be the Nebworth one, where they're on the Dole and then 18 months later, they're selling out, you know, they're doing these two nights at Nebworth.
Yeah.
It's such an amazingly quick journey that they get to the top, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. That's why I call it a comet. You just think it can't get any bigger and it got bigger. Hang on to the, you know, you're just hanging on there, sort of swinging off the back of it, thinking, oh my God.
So last year, there was this lovely moment where between the lockdowns, the launch of the book with Daniel Rachel, which would have been the 25th anniversary of those two nights at Nebworth, 25 years on, there was this wonderful moment where the book launch, you and Daniel Rachel launched this beautiful coffee table book, which we'll talk about in a sec of this anniversary. And it was the first time out of lockdown where I'd been to like a little gig, because there was Simon Fowler and Oscar from Ocean Colour Scene did a little set because they were part of the support acts at Nebworth along with pretty much everybody else from the Britpop time, apart from Weller, I think. Everybody was there. The Manics and Prodigy and Chemical Brothers. It was this lovely moment where they did a few songs acoustically, and I got a little tear in my eye. It was like live music again. I don't know what it was, or I'm getting old and it felt like that much time had passed or something. I'm not sure, but it was a really emotional evening.
Yeah, it really was, wasn't it? And then we just heard that Charlie Watts had died just before we started it, and I was like, oh, one of the Rolling Stones is gone, and one of the greatest drummers on earth, you know, and one of the great, and I was, you know, what an evening that was. It was, you know, we were so deprived of anything live around that period of time. I also went to Glastonbury because for my documentary around that time to do some filming, and it had been cancelled. It was a second cancellation, and the pyramid was there, a skeleton of this pyramid. And walking through that field, I was thinking, you know, I was talking to the camera and saying, you know, God, you know, all the millions of people who've been here, it means so much to them. And, you know, there were some tears there as well. So, yeah, absolutely. It's so important, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. Now, let me take you back to Nebworth, because, I mean, it didn't get much bigger than that. Was it two nights, 125,000? And people each night. I mean, the stories of the amount of celebrities flying back and forth in helicopter to go and get wellies and all kinds of stuff was, I mean, it's just massive. These city, this almost like this city that they built for these gigs. It's not like Nebworth was a regular music venue, but I guess from your point of view, it's a bit different. And I remember reading in the book about how you're staring down a lens at it, and you're so in the moment that maybe you're not so aware of the kind of surroundings and the hugeness of it, because you're there to do a job and you've got to capture the band, right?
That's true. And also I was doing childcare. I had my 8-year-old daughter with me for, I think it was the first night, or perhaps it was the second. I can't remember which night it was. And I had to park her on the stage while I did the job. We can't just leave an 8-year-old, can you? I mean, I said, stay there and don't. And she said, well, can I have one of those balls? You know, those huge Adidas balls. I said, well, you get one of those if you stay right here. But I mean, I was wandering around shooting, but I was also doing that. So I'm the wrong person to ask anything about Nebworth, because I was busy shooting or doing childcare. My car broke down afterwards. I had to get the AA in. So, I mean, I, you know, When you say to Noel Gallagher, the first time anyway, I asked him, what do you remember when you look at this picture of Main Road with your arms outstretched? And he went, I just thought, don't trip over those wires. Don't fuck it up. That's what his memory was. You know, you don't want to fall flat on your face when there's a crowd out there, do you? You don't want to ruin the pictures if you've been given the access and you've forgot to put the film in the camera or, you know, made some mistakes. So you tend to not really be terribly aware of anything other than what you have to do.
And it's funny, isn't it? Because you go to gigs these days and so many people are filming the gig, taking photos of the gig on their mobile phone. But this was pre that, really, wasn't it? This wasn't a thing. The shots that you've got are really the shots that people maybe have captured in their memory, but actually they didn't really exist anywhere else.
Yeah, well, that's what Noel says. You know, the last big gathering before everybody went digital, really. Yeah. That was the cusp of the digital revolution. And I had a very big groundbreaking exhibition that went along with a year later, I think it was. Yeah, my exhibition was there then at the Roundhouse. And that's when everything changed.
And it's funny, isn't it? Because it's like, I don't mind the pit. I'm happy with that. But if I go to a gig now and all I see is just a sea of phones and you end up just watching the gig through everybody else's mobile phones. Yeah, you're in the moment. We're here. It's like you're probably never going to watch back that crappy video on your mobile phone. It's like, you know, experience that. And I think that was a wonderful thing at those times, wasn't it? You know,
it is. Although, of course, I've been looking at it through a lens long before that. And so actually it's a kind of an absence. You're not really there. I mean, that's what I'm saying. Maybe actually it's more like if you're in the band and you're playing something, you're not actually there either. You mean you're just thinking, I better not screw that up. Is my amp working all right? Why hasn't the roadie tuned the guitar properly? Or why is that person staring at me strangely in the audience? You know, you might be in some other zone. You're not actually there either.
Yes.
Everybody's doing their job. The road crew wouldn't know how the gig went unless there was some fuck up at their end. So only the audience can really, and then now they're watching it, as you say, they're busy recording it. I understand the urge to want to record stuff, but it's actually you can't. That is the great irony of it all. Even at our end, at the professional end, you cannot. That's why you have to keep going.
Thinking of Oasis, there's one other shot that I wanted to ask you about, which was Heaton Park. Mm. So this would have been towards the end, right? I'm guessing this is where the generator packs up once and then a second time, right? And this is packed, tens of thousands of people. I mean, that must have been terrifying, thinking that's about to kick off.
Yeah, that was scary too. Yeah, it was really scary. I mean, they did really well actually to deal with it. I mean, Noel just sat on an amp at one point, just like that. But I mean, he didn't go away. They only went away when they had a sign that said, look, we're trying to fix a generator. But, you know, that crowd would have been there since the afternoon and they were drunk pretty much and they wanted their gig. So, yeah, that was very scary. Yeah, it was.
And I guess it's still as a photographer, it's like actually your job is still to capture those moments, right?
Yeah. I was a bit nervous about being out there, though, in case, you know, because I have been in a situation where the crowd pushes the barrier and you're trapped a bit. You know, I was figuring where I would escape to if that happened.
When we talk about the photography, what is it that keeps that spark? I mean, Paul, a music career now of, if you think about the start of the Jam, when we kind of formed it as a kid with Steve Brooks, it's 50 years ago, the Jam, right? 1972. So same timeline really for you. Yes. Entering the world of photography. And yes, Paul's still at it. You know, you're still passionate about it and, you know, and doing it. What is it that keeps you going? What keeps that kind of spark alive in this?
Well, Chrissy Hynde said it best again in my documentary thing. I'm giving you little clues as to that, but she said, I'm doing my hobby. She said, if you make money out of it, great. If it is your hobby, which is your love, isn't it? It's what you do in your spare time, isn't it? Then why would you want to give that up? You just keep doing it until you fall over, really, I think. I know there are people who do move on and do other things and they're very fulfilled by doing it, but I've got bored with the whole copyright issues, restrictions. I'm so sick of not getting a pass for things like the access. It just pisses me off now. And I think by now I should have an access to all areas worldwide for everything.
For anything and everything.
Show up and they go, yes, you can come in, do what you want to do. So I'm really pissed off about that. And I, from that point of view, I sometimes feel like I'm not doing it anymore, but not from the point of view of not being excited by a new talent. When I was at Glastonbury this year, I went to photograph Chris Difford, an old client of mine, Squeeze, and young blood was there. He was a big fan of Squeeze. And he was delightfully posed for my camera. You know, I think the session I did a little shoot with him. It lasted about 35 seconds and it really made my day. That's what I want. I want to be able to go to Billie Eilish and go, look, just sit over there by the mirror. Okay, cool. Click, click, finish, Billie Eilish. Not you can't come in anywhere near Billie Eilish because you know, not Kendrick Lamar's not available, you know, screw all that. Paul Weller said to the fans, you can come in. He said to me, you can go on the stage. It was okay. And we were still one generation on from Barry Wenzel's generation, where Jimi Hendrix said, let's, you know, come and hang out for a week or something like that. So, or the Beatles, you know, where they published in the Beatle Monthly and said, Paul's got a new house. Here's the address. Do pop in. Not quite, but, you know,
yeah,
you know, the access has gone. We can't go back. And it's quite right that we shouldn't go back, really. We should always go forward. But the enthusiasm and the talent doesn't go away. It keeps renewing itself.
Love it. Oh, I love it. Tell me about this documentary then. So when are we going to get to see it? Where, what stage are we at right now?
Well, there's a whole chunk of it now. And I'm just working with the director on polishing it. And we're going to have to get music rights. I think we need a bit of money, actually, to finish it, because we did it for a shoestring. Maybe somebody like Simon Helfont will come and help us with it, actually. You probably know Simon Helfont, do you?
I've read his book recently, the Oasis book recently, yeah.
Yeah, that's great. That Supersonic one, yeah. We'll see. I'll let you know.
Okay. Yeah, you too. That's a really exciting project. That sounds great. Hey, look, I love talking with you, Jill. I have two final questions for you before you head off. They're the same questions that all our guests get. So you're allowed one Paul Weller song for the rest of your life. It can be The Jam, The Style Council, or Solo. What would you pick?
Oh, gosh, you've put me on the spot there. There's one in my head, but I may have to come back to you on that one.
You can sing it.
No, I cannot sing it. I think Wildwood, actually.
Ah.
I think, actually, because it reminded me a bit of like Led Zeppelin, when Led Zeppelin used to start some of their most beautiful songs acoustically, and then it would go into some... Those are so touching, those pieces of music. So yeah, that was so unexpected from somebody who came out of punk.
And then final question. So you mentioned about kind of passion points and or hobbies rather that you get paid for. I used to be a radio presenter. That was my big life dream.
Very, very professional, I must say. I'm amazed you're not on Radio 1 or some other.
Oh, bless you. So
thing. You're very good.
Well, I did send them my demo, but you know, and that was my job for ages and ages. And I kind of did fall out of love with it and went and did something else instead. But 10 years ago, I gave up that radio dream, if you like. But I had one big regret. My big regret was that I never got to interview Paul Weller. So I've created a podcast to make this happen.
Have you asked him? Have you thought of asking him?
Well, this is a really long question. Like, it's now over 120-odd episodes now to get to the answer. Paul, will you do an interview? But we're having a lovely journey on the way. But if it happens and I get to chat to Paul at the end of this podcast series, what do you think I should ask him? What would you like to know? Anything?
Just say why.
That could mean so many things.
Exactly.
Like, why bother? Why are you still doing it? Why did you get started?
And then that's it. You only need one question and the rest of the interview will answer it for you.
That is amazing. Jill, it's been lovely. Lovely to see you, and thank you so much. And thank you so much for the images and the photography and everything, because you've captured so much for so many music fans. It's fabulous.
Oh, I'm pleased. Thank you very much.
Well, there you go. My thanks once again to another fabulous guest on the podcast, Jill Firmanovsky. What a legend. And if you want to find out more, do check out my website, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. Just head to the show notes for this podcast to find photos, links, and details of everything that we talked about. I've even put up some scans of that copy of Face magazine that we talked about, courtesy of the mighty Neil Sheesby. Yes, Brother Shees from Stone Foundation. Thanks for sharing that, sir. Whilst you're there, I'd encourage you to visit rockarchive.com, that incredible site that we talked about. You'll also find on my page 10% off. Yes, a discount code if you want to buy a print between now and January the 7th, and a competition to win a very special print of Mr. Weller by Jill on my website as well. Find all the details, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. And if you enjoy the podcast, please do leave a review. Yes, 5 stars will be lovely on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. Spread the word on social media as well. Let all your Weller-loving, the Jam-loving, the Style Council-loving, heck, any music-loving fan would love this podcast, right? Let them know about it. Share the news, the Paul Weller Fan Podcast. And if you fancy buying a virtual coffee, you can do that in my store as well. Doing exactly that in the past week or so, Colin and Jennifer Marsh say loving the podcast, learning so much about the inner workings of the Weller world is a treat. Keep up the good work, Dan. Keep the faith. Well, thank you to you both. Hi to Grant. Cheers for your virtual coffee as well. Hi, Ian Traynor. Hello, sir. Vince Bicarino says, keep up the good work, Dan. Thanks for your generosity, sir. Hi to Sean Wilson says, hi, Dan. Massive thanks to you and what you have achieved so far, and also for passing on my questions. Much appreciated, my friend. Take care, Dan. Sean.
Well, cheers, Sean. Hi to Alex McLaughlin. Says, Merry Christmas, mate. Pour this towards a bottle of wine for you and your good lady and a couple of selection boxes for the kids. Enjoy your holiday. It's well earned. All the best, Alex. Hey, Alex, thank you so much once again for your support. It's really appreciated. Hi to Terry Stewart, who bought me a coffee. Here's a nice one. Rob Pollard says, as of the 3rd of December, 2022, I have just celebrated my 45th year of being a Jam Style Council and Paul Weller solo fan. Keep the podcast going, Dan. It makes Tuesdays worth it. And finally, thanks to Gary Tomkinson, who says, fantastic stuff. Looking forward to the book. You're making me feel guilty now, Gary. I really should pull my finger out and get on with it, shouldn't I? Hey, thanks for listening. Cheers for your virtual coffee too. Cheers to all of you in 2022 for supporting the podcast, whether you've been listening, whether you came to one of our live events, you bought merchandise, a virtual coffee, or you've just spread the word. It's all greatly appreciated. And who knows, 2023, it's got to be the one, right? You know where I am, at WellerFanPod on Twitter or Instagram and Facebook, Paul Weller Fan Podcast. You can get in touch via the website as well, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. Thanks for listening. I'll see you in 2023.